Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. We're continuing to follow the Gospel of St. John, this time chapter 12, verses 20 through 30. It's the conclusion, actually, of Jesus' time explaining and proclaiming and the beginning of his time to with great resignation to begin to move toward the inevitable in Jerusalem, to move toward the agony, the passion, the death, and so forth. So he goes, it says, among those who went up to worship at the festival were some Greeks. These approached Philip, who came from Bethsaida in Galilee, and put this request to him, "Sir, we should like to see Jesus." Philip went to tell Andrew, and Andrew and Philip together went to tell Jesus. And Jesus replied to them. First of all, that they go to the Greeks who may have been Greeks who were very favorable to Judaism, and they might actually have been willing to come and to participate in festivals and so forth. And they approach Philip. Now, what Philip's background really is, we don't know, but he does have a Greek name and not a Hebrew name. And he is from Galilee, and so perhaps there is some kind of Gentile connection with Philip. And so Philip and Andrew then go, and they tell Jesus that there are some Greeks there. There are those people there who would like to meet him. Those who are at the festival, those who are kind of interested in Judaism at least, and had heard of Jesus and wanted to know him, to meet him. And then Jesus replies to them, and for us to follow this as a narrative, it's a little bit difficult. It seems in a way to kind of stray off course, but it really doesn't. And so Jesus turns and he says, and this is incredibly important what he says. He says, "Now the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." In John's terms, the glorification of Jesus is the crucifixion and then the resurrection. There is not the glorification in the resurrection without the crucifixion. And there is a reason for that, which comes out in this answer that Jesus gives to Philip and Andrew. "For I tell you most solemnly, unless a wheat grain falls on the ground and dies, it remains only a single grain. But if it dies, it yields a rich harvest. Anyone who loves his life loses it, and anyone who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life." This is a hard saying, and we have to really look at it, because basically it's one of these things, unfortunately, that we can hear over and over again in the gospel and really kind of just let pass by because it's a little problematic, and how difficult is that? But Jesus starts out with an example. The grain of wheat that falls to the ground. If the grain of wheat persisted and remaining a grain of wheat and says, if it had a will and a consciousness and said, "I don't want to be put in the ground. I don't want to start to decay. I don't want to go through some great metamorphosis. I don't want to change," and so forth, then the grain of wheat would be actually nothing. It would have been just kind of an infinitesimally small kind of particle in the world and disappear without leaving any kind of residue at all. Instead of growing into wheat, which could become bread, which begins part of the nutrition of the world in which we live and the life of the world in which we live and so forth. And so in that sense, a little grain makes a great contribution by being one of many. But then Jesus says, then after that, anyone who loves his life loses it. Anyone who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. And this is the thing that I think is extremely problematic for us. Because if life is a gift from God, then why is he saying that if we cling to it, we lose it, and if we hate it, we'll gain eternal life? What does all that mean? And I think that it takes us directly into some kind of problematic within our own contemporary society. Kind of takes us into a very difficult situation in our own society where the whole idea of being part of a whole has begun to break down. Part of the strength of Catholicism, when I was growing up, was the solidarity that you had. That you had a community that you belonged to, not only identifiably locally, but you belonged to a global community as well. And one, and I know it sounds kind of not very profound when people say, well, the good thing about the old Mass was you can go anywhere in the world and it's always the same. Well, that certainly was true. The problem, however, is that's a symbol of something. It's a symbol of the universality of the community to which we belonged. And so we felt like we belonged wherever we were because we belong to that larger community. And you cannot be part of a community if the only person that matters to you is yourself. You cannot be a functioning, contributing, beneficial member of a family, of a local community, of a parish, anything, if you are the most important person and your wants and your desires are non-negotiable. That's just not how life works. And what Jesus is saying, in losing our lives, we gain so much more because there's room for others and room for other realities inside of ourselves. And I had an interesting conversation not so long ago with a young couple preparing for marriage. And the young woman, a very thoughtful, very, very reflective, very good young woman, said, I asked her, you know, if she had any hesitations at all. And she said, not really. She said, there's a certain sadness, though. And I thought, I wonder, sadness, you know, you don't usually associate that with a wedding, with marriage in the beginning. And I said, what is it? And she said, because my life will be giving myself totally away to my children and to my husband, and there'll be nothing left for myself. And I thought, that's a profound statement, but profoundly untrue, that she had gone only half the journey. She had gone to this half the journey that we find here in the gospel, that anyone who loves his life loses it, and anyone who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. It was like, if you give away, if you are generous, if you are loving, then that empties you, and then there's nothing left of us. And that's what the first line of this would seem to indicate, apparently, to people. Anyone who loves their life will lose it. And so in this conversation with this young woman then, we had the opportunity to explore why that probably was not true and why maybe she had only come half the distance and not the rest of the distance. Because she got through the first part of this line in John's Gospel, but she did not get through the second part. For her to lose her life for her husband out of genuine love for her husband and her children would fill her enormously so with more than she had had when she began. We know that this is the whole idea of human love. The whole idea of human love is not that one person drains the other. It is that one person in giving to the other also receives with a greater capacity within themselves. And so, as Jesus here talks about his Son of Man to be glorified, in this Johannine sense, then basically what this is that the crucifix, which is the glorification of the Lord, becomes the symbol of love for us. That it's not that to love others is to be crucified, suffer, and die, but to love others is, at least in here, to move toward the resurrection with a greater depth and a greater fullness of life. For anyone who hates his life in this world, and certainly someone who submitted to the cross was not clinging to the here and now. Remember Jesus before Pilate. He never spoke up in his own defense. He was resigned to what was going to happen to him because he knew that in this total emptying of the self, which is what this young woman was worried about in her marriage, not worried about, but sad about in her marriage. But then through this, Jesus, through this total self-giving, through this total absolute love for humanity, he rises from the dead in glory. And that's kind of the paradigm of what he's talking about in our lives. It's not that we hate ourselves, and it's not that in hating ourselves, we therefore choose in some way, shape, or form to be empty and lonely and heartless. That's not what we do. And so actually, what the young woman said, this passage here is what she will hear this Sunday. Anyone who loves his life loses it, and anyone who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. That's the crucifixion. That is the crucifixion, and that is the paradigm of love in all of our lives. Do husbands sacrifice of themselves for their wives? They must. Do wives sacrifice of themselves for their husbands? They must. Do parents sacrifice of themselves for their children? They must. But in the end, if they do it generously and well, how many of them would say, I wish I had never gotten married, I wish I never met you, and I certainly regret having all these children? I've not heard that. I've not heard that from people who are serious about giving of themselves for another. Certainly many, many marriages break down because people can't or won't do it. But anyone who sets out to do that, I have never seen them come up empty. And anyone who sets out to do that is always in many ways a fuller, more complete, and happier person than the more joyful person inside of themselves, even though there's much, much sacrifice. Nevertheless, they find that their life has more fullness and more meaning, and they are more prepared for eternal life through this giving away of the self to another, to others. It's the fundamental principle for humanity to grow in grace and wisdom and knowledge. And then, Jesus says, after he says this, if a man serves me, he must follow me. For wherever I am, my servant will be there too. And anyone who serves me, my Father will honor him. And so if we say that we are disciples of the Lord, then we follow where the Lord goes, even in difficult times. I don't know how many people you hear come and talk and kind of, in a way, shamefacedly talk and say, you know, I hear the church put down, and I hear Christianity put down, and I kind of fail to say anything. I've kind of failed to be a witness of any kind. That's wonderful that they acknowledge that, because as disciples of Jesus, they know, not that they have to get in fights and all of that, but they know that in some way, shape, or form, they have to witness to the discipleship that they have and to the person to whom they are disciples. And Jesus assures us that if we do that, you know, we can get in all sorts of, there's all sorts of ways to witness. And it doesn't, like I said, arguments aren't necessarily the most effective way. I know very few people whose minds are ever changed by arguments. But I do know a lot of people whose minds are changed through the witness of others' lives. I know there was a young man one time who was not a Catholic, who I was talking to, and on an airplane, actually. And he was telling me of his experience of being part of a community in this town, city where he had worked for a couple of years is all he was working there. He had become part of a community that was Catholic. And he told me the thing, he said, you know, the thing that really, I don't know what became of him, but he said, the thing that impressed me is that I never saw more joyfulness in people, and I never saw people more understanding and patient with one another. Well, you know, that's wonderful if that's true in people's lives. And it was a powerful witness. They didn't have to say, why aren't you Catholic? They didn't have to argue with him. They had to live the faith. And they did apparently live the faith and live it well. And he went away impressed that Catholicism was not this strange phenomenon that he heard talked about elsewhere. He saw it lived. And seeing it lived, he came to understand it more deeply. And that's the whole business of discipleship. Doesn't mean it's going to end well. You know, we celebrate the Feast of Martyrs. That doesn't mean that from our standards, that discipleship with the Lord is always going to end on a happy, joyful note. But martyrs don't go to their death usually with deep regrets and sorrow and resentment and anger or anything like that. I think there's a great example, for instance, in Sadie Stein. She knew very well where she was going and what was going to happen and what was going to happen to the people with her. But in the sightings of Edith Stein on the trains that were going through Germany on their way to Auschwitz, when the doors were opened to clean out the cars, they saw, and there's a witness, they saw a woman in a brown robe comforting the mothers and the children, helping and supervising the cleaning out of the car, organizing, in other words, creating some kind of a livable space for people who were doomed, when she knew, even if they did not, what the ultimate outcome of it would be. And I think that this idea of a peacefulness, the peacefulness of Maximilian Kolbe, the peacefulness of Edith Stein, the willingness of them, even when they could have been in great anguish and anger and resentment and fear and terror, from the depths of their hearts, they gave of themselves to others and earned the crown of martyrdom and therefore eternal life. So then Jesus says, now my soul is troubled. What shall I say? This is a line that the Synoptic Gospels pick up with a great degree of frequency. Now my soul is troubled. The very thing he says in the Garden of Gethsemane, when he sighs, when he weeps, when he says, Father, if it be your will, let this pass from me, but your will, not mine, be done. All of this, there is kind of a depth of resignation and sadness. You know, this is another thing of a kind of sadness. I remember another time speaking with a lady who was dying, and she did not want to die. And I asked her, I said, well, are you afraid? And she said, no, I'm not afraid at all. She says, but I don't want to leave the people I love behind. And so with an openness to death and a desire for death, that very human love was the only thing that she was sad to leave. Obviously, she will never leave that. It will be with her forever. But it was interesting to me and consoling to me to know that in real faith she wanted to go. She was sick. She wanted to be with the Lord, but the sadness was leaving behind her family, the people she loved, and her friends, and so forth. And that's very human. And that's something about what Jesus is talking about here. Now my soul is troubled. I am in some way, shape, or form, know what my destiny is, know what my fate is. And at this stage of the gospel, he's got a ways to go, carrying that with inside of him. But what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? It's the very same thing he said in the garden. Your will, not mine, be done. I resign to the will of the Father who loves me. For his love for me is so abundant, that even though I have, as a human, I have the human fears of pain and death and so forth, nevertheless, this is an act of love and a response in love of my giving myself, not just to the people, but giving himself completely also to his Father, and his Father completely to him. And so he said, but it was for this very reason that I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name. And so he says, I accept, I acknowledge, I know. We can't take Jesus and take his humanity away from him. We cannot take his divinity away from him either, and it is in the depths of his divinity that he and the Father are one. It is in the depths of his humanity that he loves the Father in a way that we know what the word love means. But he also loves us. And so he said, Father, glorify your name. He doesn't say, Father, make me a hero. Father, make me somehow or other, you know, a great image in the world. He said, no, glorify your name. For when the name of the Father is glorified, thus too is the name of the Son glorified, and so too the name of the Spirit. For the Father and the Spirit and the Son are one. And so then a voice came from heaven. The Father answers him, I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. That he is promising, he is reassuring his Son, who is engaged in being human, of the fact that love is what this is all about. The Passion story and Good Friday is a very dramatic story of what it means to love. And like I said, that doesn't mean everyone has to go through physical suffering and pain in order to love another. But there's great sacrifices which love demands of us. And if we cannot sacrifice, we cannot love. And that's exactly what Jesus is doing, and the Father is saying, and my name will be glorified in this, and it will be glorified again in the events that take place. So people standing by who heard this said it was a clap of thunder, and others said, no, it was an angel speaking to him. And Jesus answered, it was not for my sake that this voice came, but it was for yours. And so by not understanding it, he says, now is to go on. The sentence is now to be passed. Now sentence is being passed on this world. Now the prince of this world is to be overthrown. And when I am lifted up from the earth, I shall draw all men to myself. That I shall draw all men to myself reiterates the problem of the Pharisees in the verse before this gospel begins. They say everyone is following him. And Jesus is saying, yes, everyone will follow me. And by these words, he indicated the kind of death that he would die. So he comes again. We saw in the last gospel of John that there was condemnation for not believing. And now we see in this the sentence is being passed on this world. And the prince of this world is to be overthrown. And when I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw all men to myself. The prince of this world is the darkness. It is the serpent, the symbol of the serpent, the symbol not only of evil itself and sin itself, but of our own evil and our own sin as a loathsome and an ugly thing to look at. When Jesus talked about telling Nicodemus about Moses lifting up the serpent, that's the symbol of evil. It comes to us from the book of Genesis. It's a symbol of evil. It's a symbol of sin. And in the desert, when the people faced themselves as to their infidelity, they could live. And here he is saying that all the way through, that people who acknowledge their sinfulness and are open to him and to his word are the ones who give away of themselves, become his disciples, and come then to understand the drama that is about to take place. And in retrospect, will continue to understand the drama that has taken place. From our perspective, somewhere between 1950 to 2,000 years ago, this all transpired. And we ourselves are participants in that, in the liturgy that is coming forward to us in Holy Week. And so liturgy is not a drama of sorts or simply a play. The liturgy is an engagement with the events of our salvation. And it is an ancient form of that, derived from the depths and the ancient ways of Judaism, that we become present to our deliverance, present to our salvation. For the Jews, it was Passover. For us, it is the liturgy, and especially the liturgy of Holy Week and Easter. So then, by these words, he indicated the kind of death that he would die, when I am lifted up from the earth. And so this theme then, the theme in Jesus's discourses, as he begins to approach a fuller consciousness with others of what his fate is, of what his destiny is going to be, he tries as best he can to draw them into discipleship, not because he wants them just to be his disciples, but because in that is their salvation. In that is their interior transformation. And we can say they handled it badly at the crucifixion. Peter denies him 3 times. But Peter also weeps for having betrayed the person he loved. And that's so human. And that's part of the great appeal of Peter the Apostle, that the depths of his humanity should open doors of understanding in our own hearts and in our own minds. For it is, in fact, the ones who live deeply from within the nature the Lord has given them who eventually come to understand what it means to love, what it means to believe, and what it means ultimately then to be a disciple of the Lord through this world and into the next.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com. Then he said,